I next met with Dr. Frank Worden, and to begin, he provided an overview of what he sees as the key focus of the head neck cancer multidisciplinary team he works with.
What's really important about these head and neck cancer patients is that a large number of them present with curable disease. So if we compare head and neck cancer to lung cancer, 90% of our patients present with local or locally advanced disease that's treated with surgery or combined chemoradiotherapy. And the vast majority do receive some kind of organ preservation or chemoradiotherapy. And in doing so, the treatments are very intense and the side effects can be rather devastating. So we have developed a multifaceted clinic within my practice where I have two very skilled nurse practitioners who oversee the clinic. They evaluate patients after receiving blood work prior to receiving chemotherapy. They assess their overall well-being, the state of depression they may be in, their nutritional status, and write for narcotics, contact me with any issues that may happen. We also, within the team, have a dietitian who will see them regularly. So if the patients are experiencing problems with weight loss, you know, in particular more than 10% or so, we'll recommend feeding tube placements. We encourage these people to swallow regularly and look after them on a weekly basis to make sure they're actually swallowing regularly, because if we don't do that, they can lose their ability to swallow. And so that is something we hammer into the patients when they come into the clinic, but we have to keep reinforcing it or re-educating as they come in for these weekly visits. We have a social worker. So head and neck cancer is associated with a high rate of suicide and high rate of depression in a lot of these patients. And the treatments in themselves can be very disfiguring and very long and drawn out and lead to a substantial amount of depression on top of a lot of patients having other social issues and problems within families and work and things like that. So our social worker plays a vital role in this clinic as well.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard about suicide before. What do you think's going on?
There is a high addiction potential, so a big number of these patients are smokers and alcohol. So it's not infrequent. We see patients coming in with histories of extensive consumption of alcohol and smoking. Interestingly, too, we are seeing a large number of patients who have HPV-driven tumors, and these are usually younger people, particularly younger men. And that in itself can be a source of anxiety, as these people are in the prime of their careers, they have young families, and now are facing, you know, potential loss of life, though these cancers are very curable. But nonetheless, these treatments can be devastating and do have an alteration on their overall well-being for a short period of time and even, you know, can be long-lasting.
When you think about, you know, an experienced medical oncologist who's been in practice for a while, are there any sort of myths or misperceptions or things that you see people doing that or not doing, you know, from a practical perspective while patients get chemo radiation therapy that you think could improve care?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's now published literature that suggests that patients with head and neck cancers oftentimes do better treated at centers of excellence. And again, talking about this multifaceted or disciplinary clinic that I've been speaking with you about earlier does probably allude to that, that these patients do need comprehensive care. And I don't think people who treat these patients regularly often know the degree or the depth of care that these patients require. So from, you know, that standpoint, I think people need to be aware that, and because they're rare, if they're seen in the community, that they need to be evaluated by a qualified head and neck surgeon and a radiation oncologist who is very detail-oriented and has expertise or experience in treating head and neck cancer patients.
Maybe we can, you know, kind of get into this a little bit by going through some of your cases, beginning with this first patient.
Yeah, so this was a 52-year-old gentleman, actually. He has a T2N2M0, squamous cell carcinoma of the head and neck, who is P16 positive. So we now know in head and neck cancer that P16 is a surrogate marker for HPV only in oral pharyngeal cancer patients. So this gentleman presents with a locally advanced oral pharynx cancer.
Did he have a smoking or alcohol history?
No. So this gentleman didn't. He was maybe a light drinker, but had no consumption of tobacco products. Was actually an attorney, a very fit and healthy man, 4 children, married. And outside of that, has a history of rheumatoid arthritis. And overall, his performance status is quite good, but nonetheless, the rheumatoid arthritis is well controlled with certain medications. methotrexate and some of these other medications have led to his creatinine being somewhat limited. So in fact, his creatinine clearance turned out to be 30 mils per minute. So again, despite his good care of taking care of himself, he does have this comorbidity leading to a creatinine clearance that's not acceptable for platinum agent. So we typically think about giving cisplatin when someone has a creatinine clearance of 60 cc's per minute or higher, and we'll give carboplatin when that occurs, but only if the creatinine clearance is above 30 cc's per minute.
Could I just ask what your thinking was in terms of the cause of the renal dysfunction?
So renal dysfunction is probably long-term related to low-grade hypertension that hadn't been controlled earlier, and perhaps related to some of his rheumatoid arthritis medications. He had been taking non-steroidals up until a point where he was switched over to methotrexate. So probably related to a combination of factors.
So can you talk about your assessment of him and your treatment plan?
Yeah. So like I said, when he came in, this guy was, you know, despite having these comorbidities, is someone who works out, he takes care of himself, he doesn't have a smoking history, though he has limitations on what we would give as standard of care. Standard of care today in 2017 still remains cisplatin with radiation therapy for locally advanced head and neck cancers. Though there is a lot of work being done to reduce or de-intensify therapy, but until we have further data, the data exists as such that we treat such patients with cisplatin and radiation. Again, because his creatinine clearance was so poor, and even to the point where he wasn't able to receive carboplatin because his creatinine clearance was even less than 30 cc's per minute, we gave cetuximab. So cetuximab is a monoclonal antibody against the epidermal growth factor receptor. It's now approved by the FDA and has been for some time, and is an acceptable treatment, a standard treatment through a phase 3 study conducted by James Bonner several years ago, comparing cetuximab and radiation to radiation therapy alone. And we do know based on this data that cetuximab is an effective radiation sensitizer. The question is whether or not it's more effective than cisplatin. In this particular case of this gentleman, we do have a study that is now closed, RTOG 1016, which enrolled 1,000 patients, 500 with cisplatin and radiation and 500 with cetuximab and radiation. It's a non-inferiority study, and in order for it to be positive, it has to be less toxic and non-inferior to the standard cisplatin and radiation. So until we have really good definitive data saying that this is how we can treat patients, you know, with cetuximab, we only use it, or I use it in my practice, for patients who are not candidates for cisplatin therapy or carboplatin therapy in the case of this gentleman.
I'm just kind of curious, what do you think that trial is going to show?
It's interesting. I think this is my gut instinct, based on what I've heard from one investigator, that it probably is the cetuximab arm less toxic than the cisplatin arm. I think overall the study will be negative. However, in a small subset of patients, those with low volume disease and those who are non-smokers, I think it'll be a positive study in that subset. But this study also includes people with, you know, heavy smoking histories, T4 and N3 tumors, in addition to the low-grade, you know, low-volume tumors. So I think overall it'll be negative, but I think when we tease out the data, there will be a subset of people who may benefit or show non-inferiority to cisplatin radiation. But it'll probably be those with no smoking histories and low volume of disease.
So what happened with this man?
So this man was treated definitively. He got through his treatment, okay. He experienced the acneiform rash that the majority of the patients experience when receiving therapy. The good thing is he was followed again in our symptom management clinic, as we spoke about earlier, and the gentleman was able to receive all doses of the cetuximab. He went on then 3 months post-treatment, a repeat PET scan was done. PET imaging is usually done prior to the start of treatment to look for distant mets and to evaluate response. The 3 month post-treatment PET imaging showed no evidence of cancer, and the gentleman continued to follow in our clinic until the side effects from his cetuximab and radiation therapy had subsided. That did occur probably about 6 to 8 months out. He was pretty much sailing on his own, no longer requiring nutritional supplements, was off all his narcotics. I mean, this was a pretty motivated gentleman. In fact, you know, once he was switched to his methotrexate for rheumatoid arthritis, he was put back on that after he received his therapy and is doing quite well and is followed with our radiation oncologist and our surgeon.
So how would you compare his course to what you typically see with cetuximab radiation? Was his typical?
Pretty much typical. This gentleman, I have to say, was pretty motivated. So he was one who was constantly checking in regarding side effects. He has a little bit of difficulty with some mucositis, so stomatitis can be an issue acutely with patients receiving cetuximab and radiation, and he did experience that. But again, because this guy is very educated, he has a very caring family who was there to support him. He pretty much is what we expect, and I say sailed through the treatment as best he could. So he's someone who I would say did well. I think in general, the cetuximab and radiation is better tolerated than cisplatin radiation, so that's probably why he had lesser issues. And I do remember in this particular case too that he had his rash, or the acneiform rash that arises from cetuximab, wasn't quite as severe perhaps as in, you know, some patients. And it's hard to judge, you know, what degree of rash patients will experience. His was probably somewhat moderately high, but not excessive.
How do you approach the rash? Do you do anything preemptively? And what about treatment-wise?
Yeah, it's a good question. So for the rash up front preemptively, we will prescribe tetracycline. So we give doxycycline 100 milligrams twice daily, and we tell them to start taking the doxycycline as soon as you take your first dose of cetuximab. And this is based on data that my dermatologist has published in the past who has been interested in studying such agents. We also give them prescriptions for triamcinolone cream and lecithin and tell them to bathe in things like Dove, which is a moisturizer, versus Dial soap, for example, that has more harsh chemicals or more perfume that can lead to issues. So we see them regularly. We make sure they have plenty of emollients. We make sure their skin is well hydrated. We make sure they stay hydrated with IV fluids. And, you know, like I said, the oral consumption, as we talked about earlier, the fluids, not only to, you know, preserve their swallowing functions, but to keep them hydrated. So overall, this gentleman did quite well, you know, with the expectations that were set forward and with his ability to comply with the treatment pretty well.
I noticed that you had a really great paper in Oncotargets and Therapy on a review of ERBB2 family inhibitors in the treatment of head and neck cancer. Can you kind of like provide an overview of what you covered in that paper?
Yeah, so we talked about cetuximab. We talked about a couple other agents that had been tried and used in head and neck cancer, panitumumab, which didn't really pan out to show as much benefit perhaps as the cetuximab did for reasons that aren't really, you know, quite clear. There also looked at some of the EGFR family, or erlotinib, which had very modest or mild activity in this patient population. So it was kind of looking in general at these agents and kind of focusing primarily on the use of cetuximab in both metastatic and in locally advanced patients.
What about small molecules, TKIs?
So erlotinib has been, like I alluded to, studied earlier. We haven't had much of a signal as compared to lung cancer. So there was some stabilization in some patients with metastatic disease, but not enough to really call a home run. And so these agents haven't been explored any further.
Let's move on and talk about your second patient.
This is a gentleman that I'm following actively in our clinic. And this gentleman is 63. And he is a person who's relatively local to Detroit and worked as a machine operator at one of the automotive companies in town. And he had a T3N1 squamous cell carcinoma of the tonsil. And the patient was initially treated up front, did well for about 6 months, and then he failed in the neck. His disease came back in the neck. So he then presented back to the ENT surgeon for an evaluation. And at that time, they decided to do a neck dissection. And when they prepped him for the neck dissection, he was present in the surgery suite, and the astute otolaryngology resident noticed these lesions on his neck. So they aborted the procedure, biopsy lesions, and found that he actually had dermal mets on his neck.
Wow.
Which prompted further workup, and he was found to have recurrence again in his neck that was prompting them to surgery, in addition to lung metastases. So because he was a failure of chemotherapy and radiation, and he's someone who did receive platinum therapy, we were conducting a clinical trial through one of our companies, and the patient actually received nivolumab, and he received it through the clinical protocol. And interestingly, I'd love to show you the x-rays because you can see the course of shrinkage of this gentleman's tumor over the course of about 6 to 8 months. So there first was a very modest response, not much change. And then 4 months later, there was a shrinkage. And then it started taking off where by 8 months, it was completely gone. And it was one of those cases where I went down to the radiologist because I couldn't find it. And I wanted to know where to measure my recessed measurements to send, you know, in for the company to report the data. And the radiologist says, we can't find it. The tumor's completely gone. So we continued to treat him monthly. He was very compliant. Interestingly, and even our data shows this in the published paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, that patients who have received these checkpoint inhibitors and nivolumab, their quality of lives got better. I mean, this gentleman was struggling, and I didn't really talk about this earlier, but because of the involvement in his neck and prior to the aborted procedure, he was having difficulty with swallowing and a lot of aspiration, which isn't uncommon for such patients. He was kind of teetering on the verge of almost going into hospice. I mean, a performance status good enough to go on clinical trial at A2, but we were kind of concerned about him. Interestingly, Dr. Love, after receiving the treatment and the cancer going away, this guy is back to normal as he can be, obviously, after having, you know, some of these procedures and whatnot. But it's amazing. He went into his backyard and he built a shed. He went hunting and he continues to do so. So at 2 years, he decided he was done, you know, taking treatment. He and his wife had said, well, we've read that side effects can be, you know, worse now at 2 years. We're just going to stop. I said, fine. And so the guy has been off now for about 6 months and he continues to be disease free and doing just fine.
That's interesting. Actually, it's the second patient today I've heard about who was on the verge of going into hospice and went into complete remission. Must be kind of interesting being in hospice nowadays.
It is pretty amazing, yeah.
Anyhow, what about tolerability issues in this patient? Any problems whatsoever with the therapy?
Yeah, no. The single agents of these checkpoint inhibitors, so pembrolizumab and nivolumab, seem to be, you know, fairly well tolerated. I mean, they're not without their side effect profiles. We enrolled in both studies that we conducted at Michigan somewhere between 13 and 15 patients on each study, I believe. And one had developed acute pneumonitis requiring steroids, never completely recovered, and actually died in the hospital. And another one who developed low-grade hepatitis that we treated successfully with high doses of steroids. So they are not completely without their toxicities. But when you look at the published data in the New England Journal of Medicine with the nivolumab versus the second-line chemotherapy of what they call dealer's choice, the side effect profiles are much higher for the chemotherapy as compared to the patients who receive the checkpoint inhibitors. So in general, these single-agent checkpoint inhibitors are fairly well-tolerated.
But this patient, if I'm reading this correctly, now has been disease-free for 2 years?
Yeah, so at 2 years, I said he went off, and he's now 6 months out of the two-year break, and he's doing fine. In fact, he had a surgery for his knee that was bothering him, a knee replacement, but we couldn't give it to him on therapy because he'd have to take a break during the treatment. He'd have to come off study when he was on it. So again, he reached the two-year mark. He was concerned that maybe he'd start developing side effects because it had been, you know, such a period of time. There is some literature in melanoma that patients continue to respond even by stopping therapy. So that's why he decided to stop. And at 6 months now, like I said, we continue to check CT scans and his disease is still completely gone.
Can you talk a little bit about right now what data we have on various checkpoint inhibitors in head and neck cancer and how you integrate it into your clinical algorithm?
Yeah, it's a good question. So right now we have two approved agents for head and neck cancer. The first is pembrolizumab, and it was approved as the results of a phase 2 and phase 1b cohorts that were merged, showing response rates around 18% or so, and some long-term responses. And then the CheckMate paper that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and this randomized patients to nivolumab versus, I was alluding to, kind of dealer's choice, you know, chemotherapy, and showed a 13% response rate and improvement in overall survival of 2 months compared to chemotherapy, which is a pretty big breakthrough in second-line therapy. So those patients who failed platinum, you know, in the metastatic setting, that these people, you know, are refractory to agents that may work. And so this improvement in survival is actually pretty great. So based on that data, we're now using these checkpoint inhibitors in patients who failed platinum therapy. So that's how they're indicated by the FDA. So you have to have failed a platinum-based agent in order to receive the drugs. So if people have gotten chemotherapy and radiation therapy, for example, and they come back to my clinics, they've failed now, if they're not eligible for a clinical study, the first thing, you know, we'll consider is the checkpoint inhibitor, one of them, either pembrolizumab or nivolumab, that's been approved by the FDA. And there are ongoing studies now looking at combinations of PD-1 inhibitors or PD-L1 inhibitors in combination with CTLA-4 inhibitors. So it's a pretty robust group of clinical trials that are moving forward. So this is kind of a exciting time for us in head and neck cancer because we haven't really had an approved agent since cetuximab.
I assume that these agents are being looked at in trials in an earlier setting, first line chemo radiation?
Yes. So there is a study now that we're involved with looking at pembrolizumab in combination with cisplatin and radiation for people with locally advanced cancers versus cisplatin and radiation therapy. So that'll be the first study to look at people with locally advanced disease.
What do we know about treatment benefit in these patients based on HPV status?
Yeah. So It appears that people who are P16 positive do somewhat better than those that are P16 negative. Though, interestingly, when we look at the data, people who are P16 negative do respond to therapy, though it's not quite as robust as people who are P16 positive. So when the indication came out through the FDA, it didn't mandate that patients be checked for P16 status or PD-L1 status, since there were responders in both populations.
So I was always curious. It kind of is interesting. When I first thought about head and neck cancer and checkpoint inhibitors, I kind of was thinking maybe the smokers would benefit more. You know, lung cancer, you see that. But it kind of doesn't seem like it's really playing out that way, you know, in terms of major differences.
Right, right. And, you know, like I said, the P16 population perhaps does a little bit better. And that population oftentimes, as we spoke about earlier, isn't that population that smokes heavily necessarily. Usually it's the more fit, you know, middle-aged man who doesn't have heavy drinking and smoking history. So maybe that plays into that part of it. But yeah, it seems to be a little bit different than in lung cancer, where they have all these mutations, therefore are more likely to respond.
You mentioned the combination with anti-CTLA-4. Are there any data at this point in that strategy?
Not yet. Nothing that's been reported.
What about combining with other systemic strategies?
Yeah. It's like combining with chemotherapy or with cetuximab. There is talk of this, and I know some investigators at the University of San Diego have been developing a study with pembrolizumab and cetuximab. So again, that study is not open yet for accrual, but you know, it should be shortly. So the same thing with chemotherapy. I think the company was looking more up front at combinations of immunotherapy versus Extreme, which is our regimen of platinum, 5-fluorouracil, and cetuximab. So that's kind of our standard for frontline metastatic patients. So I think they're trying to look for a response with immunotherapy versus our standard chemotherapy before they kind of jump into combining the immunotherapy with chemotherapy up front. But I think it's coming.
You mentioned the fact that the label requires prior treatment with platinum. Are there situations where you want to try to give it in patients who haven't been treated, elderly, frail, comorbidities?
Yeah, so that's a good point that I think in general, because of the side effect profiles being so very well tolerated, I feel a little more comfortable in giving it to people who have comorbidities and who are elderly. Interestingly, the response rates aren't as great as we'd like them to be. You're more likely to respond to chemotherapy. However, the side effect profiles can be worse and durations of response can be shorter as compared to immunotherapy, where if you respond, you can have a very durable response to treatment. Though to get somebody to respond or find a patient to respond is, you know, treating probably somewhere between 13 and 15 patients before you see that one good robust responder. So that's been the challenge all along. There's also a population of patients, because the treatment with radiation may create more of an inflammatory microenvironment, that this abscopal effect or patients who have been treated with previous radiation may benefit. So I have a gentleman in my clinic who presented with an unknown primary squamous cell carcinoma, one we thought was of the thyroid. Interestingly, he failed upfront chemotherapy and radiation therapy and came to the clinic, and I said, immunotherapy is what I believe you should get. And I'm hoping, because you've just failed radiation, we're exposed to radiation, that we've created this new microenvironment for you that has downregulation of, Tregs and upregulation of TLIs, that he may, respond. We'll see. He just started treatment. He feels much better than he ever did before, but we'll have to wait to see if he responds or not.
So what's the current status of this patient?
So he has received two cycles of nivolumab, and like I said, he came back and he says, I feel just as good as I did before I was treated with chemotherapy and radiation therapy, way back a couple months ago with my initial tumor. I did check his CT scans after 2 months, and the disease was stable, so it hadn't changed. And I said, let's not be discouraged, because A, your quality of life is much better, which again is data we're reporting out of our CheckMate study that was conducted. And I said, your disease isn't changing, just like the gentleman I told you about earlier in the second case scenario, who didn't really respond so much at front, but as time went on. We also have data through the CheckMate study that does show people who maintained treatment. So if they presented and their disease was like this guy kind of stable, we continued, or maybe there was a little bit of progression, but not massive progression. And they were feeling well enough. We continued. And some of these patients did respond quite nicely. So I think there is some utility in following patients as such and treating them appropriately.
So I'm kind of curious, when you see a patient who you're about to begin a checkpoint inhibitor such as this patient. In your mind, you know, people always tend to, of course, present patients who do better. They're very important to hear about. But what's the likelihood that this is going to happen to somebody?
Yeah, and I, you know, mentioned this earlier that if you look at the data, it's really about 1 in 13, you know, to 1 in 15 that responds. So you come into me and you have disease, I'll say that you are more likely to have a response to chemotherapy of some kind. And if you do respond, it's more likely to be shorter lived and have more side effects. But I can give you, you know, immunotherapy, and I, you know, present the data from this gentleman, and some others have had partial responses and improvements in their, you know, overall well-being, their quality of life. But I do tell them, I said, your chance of responding is a lot less than if you received chemotherapy. But if you do respond, you may be lucky enough to get a durable response, a response for a period of time. And the problem we have today is, you know, we were talking about the P16 and the PD-L1 markers. We don't have good biomarkers to help predict response of therapy. So that still remains an issue.
Has PD-L1 been looked at as a marker in head and neck cancer, and is it useful at all?
Yeah, it's, so the same thing, you know, as with P16 status, is the people who are PD-L1 positive did somewhat better compared to standard chemotherapy in that CheckMate study, but there are also people who are PD-L1 negative who responded as well. So based on that data, it's not like the pembrolizumab data in lung cancer where you had to be PD-L1 positive in order to get pembrolizumab. It's all comers. They'll, you know, you can get it regardless of your status.
So you mentioned the low likelihood of response. What about stable disease? Do you ever see people who don't progress in 2 years or more?
I have not yet seen someone with stable disease who has not progressed beyond about a year. So I can't say I've seen long durable responses as of yet. So I'm still hoping and still looking, I guess.
So let's move on and talk a little bit about thyroid cancer. Maybe you can just sort of take a step back and sort of globally provide some perspective on, you know, what's happened in this disease, particularly that's relevant to a medical oncologist over the last couple of years.
Yeah, you know, thyroid cancer is very interesting. So I completed my fellowship in the year 2000 and took my junior faculty position then. And in seeing head and neck cancer patients, I saw thyroid cancer patients as well. And I'll be honest with you, I hated seeing those patients come to my clinic because once they became refractory to iodine, so we know the treatments up front are thyroidectomy, removal of the tumor, radioactive iodine therapy. And once they failed to respond to iodine, we're stuck. We don't really have a lot of effective treatment options, or we didn't at the time. And then slowly the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, because of the inhibition of VEGF, started coming into play. So we were involved early on with a study involving axitinib. And interestingly, talk about long-term survival, I have a patient who was on axitinib for thyroid cancer for almost 10 years.
Wow.
And so a few years back, the data with sorafenib was presented by Marcia Brose at ASCO. And this has been about 2-3 years now. And the study was positive. It was a plenary session, actually. And it shows improvement in survival over placebo. And of course, placebo would be the standard of care because we really didn't have any, you know, effective treatment strategies for thyroid cancer. So the data did show improvement in progression-free survival by a few months, and there wasn't any different overall survival because of a crossover effect, because people on placebo then were allowed to, if they weren't on the drug, to receive sorafenib. In general, the toxicities are what we'd expect with sorafenib. It's been around for a while with renal cell carcinoma and just tumors and other cancers. So some hand-foot syndrome, you know, hypertension, but manageable, very manageable. And sorafenib really kind of put the treatment of thyroid cancer on the map then. And it was then about 2 years later that lenvatinib was presented at ASCO. And lenvatinib really has been really more of the home run in this disease. So sorafenib had no complete responders in about a 12% response rate, where lenvatinib actually had a couple complete responders and a 63% response rate. Though the side effect profile is a little different, similar, but a little different, it has its share of issues. I mean, fatigue, hypertension, you know, some bleeding issues, some proteinuria. So it's not necessarily a benign drug, but nonetheless has kind of revolutionized, you know, how we treat these patients. So you have a case here that I sent you or you asked about, and it's a patient with lenvatinib who had a big tracheal mass. So this mass was pushing on this gentleman's trachea and he couldn't breathe. I was trying to manage him with albuterol and epinephrine nebulized treatments. I mean, this guy would sit in his steam shower and he would just tell me that when he described these stories, Dr. Love, I'm telling you, it would create anxiety to me in the clinic. I mean, that's just how awful it seemed. You could hear the stridor in his voice, and there was nothing we could do. He wasn't a candidate for any more radiation. We tried that. He was not a candidate for surgery. And then we treated him with lenvatinib, and luckily he was one of these responders who had a dramatic response. I mean, his trachea on the CT scan, which was shifted to the left, completely went back to the midline. And, you know, the guy is still alive today, actually, you know, breathing much better.
He's still on lenvatinib?
He's still on lenvatinib now. We started at 24 milligrams because we went with the starting dose, like, as it was in the study, but he's been switched down to now, I think, 14 or 10 milligrams because having some difficulty with tolerability, and we've had to take some breaks. But still, nonetheless, he was able to have a very demonstrable response to treatment.
What an incredible story. How long has he been on treatment now?
So probably close to 2 years.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Wow, incredible. What tolerability issues did he have with lenvatinib, and what do you see in general with the drug?
Yeah, so he had some issues with hypertension, which, you know, was fairly easy to manage with the right medications. The biggest issue that people run into is the overwhelming feeling of fatigue. They feel run down, they're tired. You know, some of them, you don't get the mouth sores or the hand-foot syndrome like with sorafenib, but just the overwhelming feeling of just being drug out and feeling very tired, the point where they just say, yeah, I need some rest here. And then this gentleman actually, I think, developed a little bit of proteinuria, which prompted us then to stop the drug and to adjust the doses. And that seems to be pretty well resolved. We put him on ACE inhibitor for his blood pressure, and that seemed to help the proteinuria as well. So he continues on the therapy, and he continues to do well. So there are people like that, you know, who do very, very well with this drug.
Are you able to clinically see the difference in response, you know, for example, comparing lenvatinib to sorafenib?
Yes. And I think it's because the response rates are so much higher with lenvatinib. So I see people who are short of breath, who their symptoms improve. It's interestingly, too, we're submitting a paper where in older people, elderly people over 65, seem to have a survival benefit, probably because the symptoms they have on top of their comorbidities improve when you give them lenvatinib. So the shortness of breath they may have, in addition to their CHF, for example, may improve. And so that can lead to actually a better quality of life and probably, you know, an overall survival benefit.
You were talking before about side effects with sorafenib, and one of the things I've heard about, particularly in patients who've been on it for a while, is kind of this muscle wasting kind of thing. Have you ever seen that? And do you see that also with lenvatinib?
Yeah, it's not a direct muscle wasting. The biggest issue with sorafenib is more of this hand-foot syndrome, where I had one guy coming in and his hands and feet were so red and the skin was so like exfoliated, where it's like the top layer of his skin and his hands and feet just kind of peeled away because he was afraid to stop the medication because it actually in his situation was working. But yeah, so I think overall, as I alluded to, the fact that these people just kind of become deconditioned because they become so fatigued, which is really a big, you know, lifestyle issue. It's in fact, when people come off of it and they start feeling better, they're like, wow, I just kind of became used to being a new me on the drug. And when they take a break, they realize the degree or the amount of fatigue they experienced and how much of an alteration in their lifestyle it really had.
What else is going on right now in thyroid cancer from a research perspective that's important to know about?
So, yeah, we're actually starting to look at the incorporation of immunotherapy with thyroid cancer. So there is a study that's in the works, should be open hopefully in the next month, and it's the administration of lenvatinib and pembrolizumab in combination. So it can be for those people up front or people who failed lenvatinib therapy and they're progressing, and so they can go on to get the combination. That's one thing. We're also looking at, can we treat patients with basically half the dose? So if 24 milligrams is the starting dose for lenvatinib, and you know, if you look, 80% of the people had to have either dosage stopped or dosage adjustments because of the intolerability. And you went on to lower doses based on the protocol. Can we start at a lower dose and still get the same benefit? So we're looking now through this study, or hopefully we'll be looking soon, at starting between 10 and 14 milligrams and, you know, seeing are the benefits there. And then at our own institution, before I had these TKI inhibitors, we know that the mTOR pathway plays a role. So Dr. Sherman from MD Anderson and Dr. Brose from University of Pennsylvania both have data that they presented, and I think may be close to being published, looking at the combination of sorafenib and everolimus and people who had progressed on sorafenib, showing some benefit, you know, in a population of patients with the mTOR inhibitor. So prior to having all of that, you know, I wanted to offer people something in my clinic, and TKIs were expensive and weren't attainable unless it was a clinical trial. I would give them the combination of an oral chemotherapy agent with an mTOR inhibitor. So I kind of borrowed the regimen from my sarcoma colleagues who were treating, you know, sarcomas with such a methodology. And interestingly, you know, they tolerate it really well. And I was like, well, I hate to take away someone's quality of life if this is going to work. So I adapted from what they were doing and treated a few patients. Some of my colleagues and I published, you know, our retrospective experience. And, you know, showed there were some people who did have some benefit. So we decided we'd write our own pilot study. So I have a very astute and energetic fellow who wrote a study with me. So we're about to launch that pilot study in about 20 patients to see if there is a benefit prospectively with the combination of an oral chemotherapy agent with an mTOR inhibitor.
I'm curious what your view is in terms of the biology of thyroid cancer and why you see responses with TKIs. And any theories about, for example, why you see more responses with lenvatinib versus sorafenib in terms of what it's hitting?
Obviously, they're very vascular tumors, so VEGF is upregulated, you know, in these tumors. So I think the primary biomarker receptor that they're working on is the VEGF receptor, which is common to both. FGF is expressed and targeted with lenvatinib as compared to sorafenib, and that may provide some advantage. There is a crossover, you know, some more BRAF, I think, with sorafenib than with lenvatinib. And I don't think people know exactly why this drug works so much better, the lenvatinib in thyroid cancer as compared to sorafenib. But overwhelmingly, it has to do with the vascularity of the tumor and inhibiting the blood vessel formation.
Would you talk a little bit about what your current algorithm is for the management of metastatic thyroid cancer, radioiodine resistant, in terms of, you know, how you sequence various agents?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think now when people come in, we have to look at them independently, and there's really nothing wrong with observation. So when we look at clinical studies, there is a non-therapeutic study we're enrolling patients on. It's called RIFTOS, where we're actually looking at the time people become refractory to iodine to when they actually go on a TKI. So that popular patients is being observed. So we look at their degree of progression. Are they asymptomatic? And those patients, you know, are treated with observation, and there's nothing wrong, you know, with that. When they come to the point where the tumor is growing more quickly or they're experiencing symptoms, then we target them with treatments at that point. So sorafenib is indicated as frontline. Lenvatinib has a front and second line indication. So I kind of look at the patients individually. And in my experience, this is kind of anecdotal, some people who have received lenvatinib then had sorafenib, because we'll go to that if they progress on lenvatinib, seem not to do as well. So I look at the patient, and the patient is relatively experiencing mild symptoms, or the degree of growth is such not causing them problems, but growing, I'll start with the sorafenib first, and then once they progressed, I'll go to lenvatinib. Now, take the gentleman I described to you in this case with the tracheal mass. I'm not going to start sorafenib in that guy. I mean, because if he responds, it's going to be very small. You know, I want a robust, big response if I'm going to get a response. So I will start with lenvatinib with those patients. So I look at the tumor burden and the degree of symptomatology, and if it's pretty severe, then I'll start with lenvatinib in those patients. And then if someone fails lenvatinib, I will go to another TKI. Sorafenib is approved, and so it's not hard to get. So I will write for sorafenib, you know, afterwards. And then we have these clinical trials, you know, coming open. So hopefully we'll learn more. There is data, too, that's been published now, Bros et al., with vemurafenib in patients who are BRAF expressors with some, you know, modest responses. So that may be an alternative therapy for them. Again, the clinical trial that we're writing with the mTOR inhibitor and the oral chemotherapy may be another option as well. So that's how I approach them.
What about third line and beyond, outside of trial?
Outside of trial. So I had a lady who was very motivated, and she came from a background of means. So she had, you know, money was really no object for her. And, you know, we were treating her with radiation and spot welding, these things we could do. She was on our sorafenib study. Lenvatinib wasn't approved for her at the time, though she would have received lenvatinib. So those agents, we tell them up front, you know, you're going to be on these two drugs. She's someone who we did treat with the mTOR inhibitor and the oral chemotherapy. But I petitioned and I treated her with axitinib. There is some published data in JCO with axitinib and then pazopanib. So those are other TKIs. So if people fail one, we do go after them. But oftentimes because of insurance restrictions and they're not indicated for approved uses, we will have to go ahead and look. We also look into the TAPER study through ASCO and MATCH studies to see if there's, you know, a drug that targets VEGF, for example. Perhaps there's a TKI available. We would offer them that. So that's pretty much what we do.
You mentioned BRAF positive disease. Can you talk a little bit more about that? What fraction of patients are? Is this V600E? And what do you see with BRAF inhibitors?
Right. So it's a relatively small population of patients where we see this. So the folliculars are more likely to be RAS and the classic papillaries are more likely to be the 600E and BRAF positive. And so we didn't participate in the vemurafenib study, but their response rates are lower than that with, you know, the TKI therapy, but not unreasonable. I mean, I think to back and pull the data again, I think it's 20% or so. So it's reasonable to consider. So if someone is positive, I definitely would pull them or petition and pull them into a therapy that I think would be beneficial for them. The side effect profile is a little bit harsher perhaps than, you know, with the TKI therapy. So it wouldn't be taken lightly. But honestly, in my practice, the majority of the people are able to tolerate some kind of TKI therapy for a period of time, and we don't really usually resolve to, you know, BRAF inhibition. Only it'd be for those people who are really, A, have the mutation, and B, who are well enough to receive the treatment.
Can you talk a little bit more about your clinical experience with and what's going on with other thyroid tumors, specifically medullary and anaplastic?
Yeah, so medullary, unfortunately, we have two approved agents, so cabozantinib and vandetanib. And these two agents are TKIs as well and have offered some benefit. Again, they were tested against placebo and did show clinical benefit in both drugs. So we offer those to patients up front. There isn't any data to say one is better than another, though I think if people respond, they seem to better respond with cabozantinib, though the side effect profile is not so great. In terms of vandetanib, there has been, again, data supporting its use to prolong QT can be an issue, you know, in such patients. So outside of that, there really hasn't been anything on the horizon. There are some new RET inhibitors that went to our International Thyroid Oncology Group meeting last May. I remember them talking about some agents that are available that are coming into perhaps clinical trial. Interestingly, these tumors are neuroendocrine tumors. And a long time ago, we used to check octreotide scans and give them octreotide, a handful of them. And now there is lutetium dotatate that soon, hopefully, will become available. The paper in the New England Journal of Medicine focused on midgut neuroendocrine tumors. And so when I spoke with my endocrinology colleagues, I asked them a little bit more about the use of this and said it'd be kind of great for medullary thyroid cancer if, you know, the patients are positive. And it seems like the indication may be for anyone who is dotatate positive on their gallium scan, their PET scan. So we eagerly await the FDA approval, which is coming late summer, I think early fall. And if it's true that any patient who is positive on their dotatate scan, their gallium PET scan, then I think that could be a reasonable option to treat such patients. So that may be something else we'll look to in the future. But outside of that, I don't have any active or open clinical trials for medullary. Anaplastics the same way. There have been a handful of things explored, some use looking at lenvatinib, for example, in TKI therapy. That's kind of in the works. It hasn't completely opened. A handful of other novel agents that really haven't panned out to be much of anything. The problem with that cancer is that the numbers are so small and far between that I don't see them that often. They come in kind of groups of two and then they get treatment and sometimes they die relatively quickly because of the locally advanced presentation of the cancer.
So this lutetium radio-labeled agent that you were talking about was just in the New England Journal. I was actually speaking with Matt Kulke, who's done a lot of GI net work with that. And I guess they've really seen, he's actually treated some of these patients. They've seen, you know, significant objective responses.
Yeah.
It seems like that would really be something exciting to bring into medullary.
That's what my, you know, plan is to talk to some of my colleagues. And I'm like, no, we're not really familiar with that. But I was just thinking because, you know, there have been a handful in the past that we have treated with. I still have one guy who, my longest surviving patient of 20 years on a medullary thyroid cancer patient. And he was octreotide positive. And years ago, before I had these TKIs available, We put them on sandostatin injections. And, you know, his disease kind of stayed stable, you know, whether that was from the sandostatin or not. I mean, people could debate that, I suppose. But nonetheless, he'd be someone who would be, I'm sure, dotatate positive. And so when the lutetium becomes available, we could treat him. And they tolerate it pretty well. I mean, we always have to look for bone marrow failure and whatnot. But I don't think that overwhelmingly has been a problem, at least from the data that I've reviewed in the New England paper. So I think it provides perhaps an opportunity for such people.
So let's finish out talking about your last patient, actually going back to head and neck, but it looks like a really interesting case.
I think this, you know, was kind of focusing on the fact that people who have HPV-positive disease, even in the metastatic setting, can do well. So we know we have long-term survivors. 85 to 90% of these people do extremely well with upfront treatment, surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, perhaps radiation therapy alone. And interestingly, you know, in this gentleman, HPV positive just showed up with a primary tonsillar tumor that was very small, less than 2 centimeters in size, was treated with robotic surgery because it's indicated for that, and was, you know, being observed, and then developed neck disease. So he underwent a selective neck dissection, was found to have one lymph node that was positive, but had extracapsular extension. So we treated this patient with chemotherapy and radiation therapy, and we're observing him. And about 6 months out, he developed a lung lesion. And so, you know, we had it biopsied. He wasn't, based on the location, a candidate for resection. So on the biopsy, it was found to be P16 positive. So, you know, assuming that the squamous cell, it's kind of hard to tell if it, you know, this is a new primary lung versus head and neck. But given his presentation, he didn't have an extensive smoking history. We, you know, banked on the fact that this was a met from his HPV positive head and neck cancer. So we then brought him back to the surgeons and said, you know, look, we think this is based on this, and then did actually convince them, kind of twisted their arms to resect the lesion. So they did go ahead and resect it. Interestingly, this guy did well for about a year, and we followed him every 3 months, and then developed an isolated liver lesion. And so I took him to interventional radiology, and I said, I know it's metastatic disease, but would you radiate it? And so we radiated this liver lesion, and this gentleman is now 2 years out from that. So here's a gentleman who started out with local disease that went regionally and then with distant metastases. Now, you know, is this gentleman cured? I would hope so, but, you know, we don't know. But I think the point of this case really is to tell us that people with HPV-positive disease do better. And there's new data emerging from Carol Fakari's group that perhaps women patients with even metastatic disease do better than men. But nonetheless, I think we shouldn't necessarily lose all hope. I do have other people that I've treated similarly that had locally advanced disease. We gave them chemo radiation, developed one isolated lung tumor, had it resected, and they've been fine. You know, I follow a guy in my clinic who's been 10 years out from that. So I think this is an example how we can target the therapy and treat these people pretty aggressively. And even if we're not curing them, we're definitely prolonging their disease-free interval.
That's really fascinating because I hadn't heard about this kind of remitting, you know, isolated MET type syndrome specifically in the P16 patients. And you say you've seen it before. Any thoughts about the biology of what's going on? Do you think it's immunologic or why do you think this happens?
I really don't have an explanation for that. And these, you know, when you asked me, I think, what interesting patient you have, this is an interesting patient because this truly isn't the norm. And there are some people who, for reasons we don't quite understand, met out very quickly, you know, and I even had one who met it out during chemo radiation and they just get this lymphangitic spread in the cancer. And this is, these are people who are P16 positive. Interesting, we just published a paper looking at the clearance of E6 and E7, the oncoprotein antibodies, and found that people who didn't clear their E6 or E7 and the ratio of clearance. So if they cleared it more quickly, you know, or didn't completely clear it, those people were more likely to have cancer come back. So perhaps targeting that patient population in the future with some kind of vaccine therapy or, you know, immunotherapy may be of benefit, but I really don't have a good understanding of the biology.
Anything else that you want to comment on, both in head and neck or thyroid, that we haven't talked about? Personal research interests of yours or clinical topics that we haven't covered that you think are important?
Well, we've kind of covered, you know, a lot of things here today. One thing that we have done research on in our own program has been chemo selection for our locally advanced laryngeal cancer patients. So we've been pretty successful, and we've just published our compiled data recently in JAMA Otolaryngology showing the benefits of giving one cycle of chemotherapy up front to patients with locally advanced laryngeal squamous cell carcinoma and looking for response. So sending them back to the surgeon after their chemotherapy has been given, letting them look on the direct laryngoscopy to see if their tumor has responded, which means it has to have shrunk or decreased in dimension by 50% or more. And if it has, treating those patients with upfront chemoradiation versus, you know, surgery. And if it hasn't shrunk or it's grown, then we take those people to laryngectomy right away. And what we've shown is that a big number of these people can survive, you know, with this strategy. So about 80% of our patients are still alive with treatment this way. So we are excited to report this data to say that we think this is a method of treatment, because some believe that people should be getting laryngectomy up front and some people, you know, want organ preservation for obvious reasons. But our method has been to try to select the best patients for organ preservation and take those patients who we think we need surgery up front to have surgery. And we do know from published data that we did a long time, or published a long time ago, that patients can actually have improvements in their quality of life because of swallowing, and they have less issues with pain and stoma formation. They can, after having surgery, you know, after chemotherapy and radiation, it's much more difficult to do the surgery than it is to do it up front. So we believe this methodology is something that could offer patients a lot of good benefit.
Have you looked in the tumor, you know, biomarkers after chemotherapy to see if there's any prediction or correlation?
Right now, and we have looked, and unfortunately, we haven't really discovered any particular biomarker, and that would be the ideal thing. But, you know, kind of like with the pembrolizumab and nivolumab and the PD-L1 and HPV, like HPV, for example, you know, is prognostic and not predictive. So unfortunately, in larynx cancer, we haven't been able to find a particular biomarker that we can isolate to kind of direct therapy. So I think the holy grail continues.
So it's kind of weird, because when you were talking about your study, which really is interesting, for some reason I flashed on what's being done with neoadjuvant hormonal therapy of breast cancer. And there they've looked at Ki-67. And if the Ki-67 drops, they think there's a, you know, favorable outcome.
Right.
And I don't know whether, you know, maybe there might be a correlation in your kind of approach. Have you thought about that?
Yeah, we've looked. We looked at various biomarkers and nothing stood out to actually tell us that this is what to look for and this is how we should, you know, predict response. So unfortunately, no, we don't have that yet.